welcome to a special summer series of A Country Breakfast here on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. Over the next few weeks, we'll be taking you all over the country with some story highlights from our team of rural reporters. This week, it's all aboard for a steam train ride on the Wilderness Railway in Tasmania's Wild West. We visit an archaeological dig on the banks of the Murray River in northwest Victoria, and pop into the small rural community of Carrington in South Australia, where a local men's choir is rehearsing for their debut performance, singing the national anthem at the local rodeo.
Let's hear that.
I think as a group it sounds pretty good, actually.
You seem surprised.
Actually, yes, it is a bit of a surprise.
So is singing something that you've done before?
No, definitely not. It's the hardest thing I've tried to do too.
So breathe in, breathe out, breathe out. Now breathe in, you're going to hold that note.
The Carrington Choir in full voice later in the program. But we start today with a toot and a hiss of steam as we clamber on board a special little train on Tasmania's west coast.
I better jump on so I don't miss the train.
And with a toot and a hiss of steam, we're off. Hello, Margot Foster with you on board a bright green little steam locomotive to travel the West Coast Wilderness Railway in Tasmania's west. Built in 1899, the Apt Railway was a marvel of human engineering for its time. The track was hewn from the wild wilderness to link the copper mining town of Queenstown with Strawn on the coast. In fact, it was the only way in and out of Queenstown for almost 50 years before the roads were built. Today, this historic railway line is a significant tourist attraction for the West Coast communities. It travels through gorgeous, cool, temperate rainforest, past quaint railway sidings, and up and over a mountain using a unique rack and pinion haulage system. So settle back and enjoy the journey.
So there's a bit of tweaking and adjustment all the way. What are you looking out for?
Just watching everything, cars, three-level crossings across. Just because it's all downhill on the brakes.
It's nice and cosy in the engine room. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Probably one of the warmest spots to be today.
Your job is the fiery today,
yep. But
you also drive.
Yep.
This is the fire.
Yep.
What do you put in there?
Oil. It's the same way a coal burner does, except we use oil to do it. So it's lifted in with the steam, made into a gas, the oil, sprayed around the firebox, and that's there, it burns that way.
So that makes it very atmospheric, particularly in the cooler climate, to see all the steam. It looks like a toy train.
From pretty much the bridge back there all the way through, it's rainforest now.
It's beautiful. I'm seeing vegetation I haven't seen in other parts of Tasmania,
Well, we've got a lot out here, it's a lot of different types of trees, flowers.
Off here?
Yep. My name is Troy O'Marney. My role today is fireman on the train.
But you're also a driver sometimes.
I also am a driver sometimes.
You're in a fairly elite group in Australia. There's not many people who get to drive a toy train.
No. I think there's roughly 8 to 10 people in Australia that get paid full time to drive steam engines. So.
Now, a lot of people who are associated with steam engines have a real love affair with them, and I know there's tremendous interest from volunteer groups and so on, and people can't wait to get their hands on them. Is that something that you have?
I didn't to start with, but it's definitely grown on me over the last 9 years, I think.
And I noticed as we were driving along, you were keeping an eye on gauges and you were tweaking little knobs and levers. Yep. What exactly were you doing?
Oil controls, providing fuel, water for the boiler. The driver does something, the fireman's got to do something to chase him. So.
Right, so you're always a team.
Yep, you spend a lot of time together, so it pays to know what the other one's doing and just keep an eye on him. And like I said, the moment he moves, you've got to move to chase him.
So you can't really take your eye off the ball, can you?
No,
because
no.
Every gauge is telling you something
significant. And not only that, you're watching the track at the same time as well, so you get a lot of trees down, being in the bush.
There was a lot of tooting along the way. What's that about?
Oh, we've got 4 level crossings before we leave town, so...
So every level crossing gets a toot?
Whistle twice, yeah.
People must get used to you rumbling by because you set off at 9 o'clock every morning. Yeah. People could just about set their clocks by you.
Yeah, no, I think it's a big thing in the community in Queenstown. You get a lot of people and kids and come out and wave.
How important is it to the town now?
Yeah, no, it is. When they first talked about closing it, it was a big thing in the community with public meetings, and there was a lot of people that wasn't real happy, so I think we got the best result.
Because it's an old fixture in the town, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been going for 14 years now.
Wasn't the engine at one point in the middle of town?
This one wasn't, but number three was, which is back there in the workshop. That was a miner siding since early 70s, I think. So it sat there for 30 years where the mining equipment is.
Wow, and then it was taken out, and that was like a sculpture in the middle of town.
That's it. And now it drives up through the town, so...
That's exciting.
Mm, yeah.
Well, I'm going to go and check out this gold panning business around the corner.
No worries at all.
Thanks very much for that, Troy.
No worries.
Well, welcome back on board, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and I hope you enjoyed your time there in Lynchford. Now, did anybody find gold today? Did anyone have a kiss from Lady Luck? No? No to all of us, it was a slap in the face from Mr. Disappointment. But that is what most of the panners out here felt. Now as we pull away from the station, if you are having a look out onto the left-hand side, if you're facing forward, you'll see the Queen River. Now some of you may have found...
So that guy pops out and does it voluntarily.
Yeah.
Amy, this is a wonderful story, and I can see everybody running to the back to look at that particular rack system. Just explain that again to me.
Well, when it was first brought out to Australia, it had never been tried before. So one of the chief engineers recommended it to the board of directors of Mount Lyell, and he'd heard about it in South America and in Europe. So the director here decided to invest in it. And what you'll have is two generic rails, which we have at the moment. So we run on a narrow gauge, which is 3'6". At the moment, we are using this rack and pinion. So you'll find a third toothed rail, which is located in between our standard rails.
And I can feel it sort of hauling us up.
Yeah, it is. So what it's actually doing is it's working like a haulage, or additionally pulling us up to the top. So.
And it's based on a clock.
It is. So you have the cogs, which are located in the engine, or the pinion wheels, and as we come over that rack rail, the teeth in those pinions find their grooves and literally lock into the teeth on that rack rail.
Is this unique in Australia?
It is. We're the only one of its kind in Australia now. There was one up at Mount Morgan, but we're the only one. And we're one of the steepest rack and section railways in the southern hemisphere.
And how long's this section?
This is about 2.5 kilometres approximately, and we've got the steepest grades on this section as well. So just near the top, it's about a 1 in 12.
Wow, and how fast are we going?
5 to 10 kilometres depending on where we are on this part of the track.
Right, so I could jog along.
You could in the earlier days, back in the Mount Lyell Railway. A lot of the people you could be able to jump off the side, they'd run along. You were never allowed to. For example, we used to have the picnic trains that ran right through to Strawn back in the day. The first one was in 1897. And the last train returning to Queenstown was always known as the Drinkers Special. And a lot of the stories go that the lads whose families, their wives, their partners had already left to go on home, and the men were left to finish the barrels. And the trains were going so slow that they'd jump off and pick a bunch of wildflowers. So by the time they got home, they hopefully wouldn't be in as much trouble.
They're great stories associated around the rail, that's for sure. This is a steep cutting, you know. I can't see the sky.
Yeah, we actually have one of the steepest cuttings in Tasmania for the railways. This one here, when it was put in 1896, was the biggest. It's known as Murray's Cat, and it's about 2.5 stories high and took about 15 weeks to dig out. Wow. Now, when you look at these cuttings, most of them on this section had to be dug out literally by hand. Many of the rocks or the types through here prevented them from using explosives. So if you picture the pickaxe, the old hand drill, that's literally how this railway was built.
And now we're really getting into forest, aren't we?
It's
completely different vegetation now.
It is, and that's the best thing about this railway experience, is not only do you have the stories, but the scenery changes so much throughout the trip. So this is a cool temperate rainforest that we're travelling through, and you can see that it is quite thick, but it's all regrowth. So when you picture the early surveyors or the men going to Queenstown to work at the mines, and even the railway men, they would have been encountering something that was quite hellish, a bit of a nightmare to all of them. But it was their mottos, like we find a way or we make it, all that determined nature, which is still evident on the West Coast, that helped them go against the odds and make it a success.
What's been the highlight for you so far on the train ride?
To see the driver from the steam train, because in the modern life we don't see the driver of the train and we don't see the engine. Then it was very incredible, yeah.
What are you enjoying so far?
The experience of the olden days, the steam and the sounds and the shuttering, it just brings back a lot of old memories for me, you know, travelling when I was a child on steam trains, yes.
And are you from Tasmania?
No, we're from New South Wales, Sydney, New South Wales.
And you haven't been let down by the train trip?
Oh, no. I'm all into mechanical things, particularly of the past and the achievements that people were able to do in such remote areas. The hard work they put in, the hard labour, and it's still operating now.
So I guess the rack and pinion must have been fantastic to see.
Oh yes, yeah. I haven't seen that before. I've seen other methods of climbing out of valleys and everything with trains, but the rack and pinion, yeah, it's amazing how it's all done.
And the highlight for you?
Oh, the highlight is the enthusiasm of the people that operate it and the presentation of the carriages and the engine, everything is in such good restoration.
There's a few more surprises to come. I think there's a turnstile and the turnaround.
Yeah,
so
I'm looking forward to seeing the changeover at the end of the line.
Hi, Mrs. Delaney.
Hello, Miss Walker. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. You look dashing today.
Thank you.
Gorgeous as always.
What are you doing out on our train today?
We're going for a bit of a stroll.
And that was Mrs. Delaney.
That's Mrs. Delaney. She's one of our modern-day station mistresses.
So this is fantastic to be able to get off the train and walk through the forest. This is cool, temperate rainforest.
Yes, and it covers roughly around 10% of the state. And many of the species you'll find here on Western Tasmania actually date back to early Gondwanian times. So they've been relatively unchanged, these species, for about 60 million years. And many of them, like these big ferns here, the Dicksonia antarctica, were here around the time of the dinosaurs. So,
and it is a completely different experience, isn't it? Actually walking through it.
And it helps to put it into perspective for what it would have been like in the early days. They would have had to have slashed their way with the machetes as they made their way through, encountered the leeches all up their legs, wet boots day in, day out, and all their supplies would have been on their backs. So you can imagine the physical labour and the wear and tear on their bodies too.
Folks, you're more than welcome to head back across this way.
We've just had a really wonderful part of the tour, doing the little walk in the forest and then seeing the train turn around. I guess this is our last stop before we do head home. How has this journey been different to the previous APT railway journeys?
One of the things that we really wanted to do was add a different twist on the West Coast and the APT Railway. So one of the biggest differences that we have is the story that we tell. So not only do we talk about the APT Railway now and the feats of ingenuity and what they achieved, but we include the West Coast as a whole. So the rival railways, the feud of our two hot-headed Irishmen that came here, one of which was behind the APT Railway and another one which was behind another equally as important railway which shaped the West Coast. So our aim, I guess, at the end of it was for people to get off the journey, have, wow, this could have been so different once upon a time. Queenstown could have been ruins, for example. So when they go off, they might want to go and explore other regional areas. So we have that economic development and we're assisting other towns, not so much Queenstown and only Strong, which is what it used to be. But you can get a taste of what the West Coast is from the railway. And when you go away to the other areas, it's all connected and it helps to put it all together and you get that great sense of community and the message of the triumphant people of the West.
Okay, great day.
No worries.
It's not too long. Well, they always say with archaeology that for about every hour you spend in the field, you've probably got about 2 or 3 days worth in the lab. We're slowly taking off the surface of the soil, so we try to find an area that's still intact so we can't see a lot of shell exposed. Then what we want to do is carefully, using trowels and brushes, get off all that sediment and then slowly work down onto the shell midden itself. So what we try to do is to keep everything intact as much as possible, and we like to record, photograph and take out all those shells individually so they can be analysed later on.
To the untrained eye, they just look like broken shells crushed into the ground. But for a group of archaeologists, these shell middens on the banks of the Murray River offer an insight into how Aboriginal people lived in this area near Lake Killaloraine thousands of years ago. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at Ned's Corner Station, a former sheep property in Victoria's northwest, where this team from La Trobe University is hard at work unearthing its past.
Hi, I'm Dr. Gillian Garvey from La Trobe University. What we're doing is excavating small 1 by 1 metre areas to try and understand, number one, how old the site is. So what we can see is we've got a lot of shell on the surface, and we have quite a good understanding of the temporal or the distribution of the shell. But what we're trying to do now is actually get below the surface and find material that's still intact, that hasn't been disturbed, and excavate it very slowly down so we can try and determine what people were eating in the past when they were living here along the Murray River, and also how old the site is.
So what is shell midden?
Shell midden essentially is just a rubbish dump, so it's where Aboriginal people have collected shells in the past from the river and come up onto the bank and sat down and cooked them and eaten them. So it's basically just the debris that's left behind after a meal.
So what's the early picture that you're starting to see from what you're collecting here?
What we can see is that we've got different parts of this shell midden, or what appear to be one big shell midden, but is probably lots of individual meals. So we're getting an understanding that even though this might look like a very big cultural site in itself, it probably actually consists of lots of small little cultural sites. So people have come here maybe over tens of thousands of years, or hundreds of years at least, collected shell from the sandy silt that's down in the river and come back up onto the shore to eat it in different places. So we can see in some parts of the midden, or in some of these different middens, people might just be collecting mussel shells to eat, but in other parts we can see that they're also collecting snail shells and eating them as well as part of their diet.
And have you been surprised by what your early findings are?
We're surprised by a number of things. Number one, we're surprised that we're only getting shell in the sites. We would have expected or liked to have found fish bones, especially fish ear bones, which are called otoliths. Those bones are very important because you can actually identify specific species based on the shape of those bones. And we're also finding no bird bones. So you might expect Aboriginal people, when they were sitting here, to also be collecting bird eggs and birds themselves. And we're actually finding no mammal bones. So we're finding no remains of meals of kangaroos or emus too. So it seems that people were specifically using this area to collect and cook shellfish only.
So where we are, the Murray River is just slowly making its way past us, and we've got mallee scrub effectively behind us. Is this a pattern that you would expect to see along the river here in this region?
Yes, you'd expect to find middens all the way along the Murray River, and some of these middens may date right up until European occupation of the area, European contact period, but you'd also expect middens to continue out into the scrub. So when you look at where the river used to go in the past, you'd expect to find middens along the old meanders, some of which are now billabongs and some of which have been not used for a long time. You'd also expect to get find middens out on the old Lunette lakes, so the old ancient lakes that were active in the past, so in the Holocene and Pleistocene, so 20,000 years ago or more, you'd expect to find shell middens around the old sand dunes.
So can you even pick up on things like how the mussels might have been cooked all those years ago?
Yeah, that's one thing you can do. And what I do want to undertake is do experiments, so looking at how they might have cooked some of these shells, because at the minute it doesn't appear that these shells are very burnt. So what we think that people are doing are actually smoking the mussel. So like you do today with mussels from the ocean, you smoke them, you don't actually put them on direct flame. And we think that's what people were doing in the past. So one thing that I would like to do is to get some modern shell and cook it, and to have a look at what happens when you cook it under different types of heat, and also using different vegetation types, because I suspect that people may have used some vegetation to try and smoke the mussel as well.
So you might be able to give some chefs a cooking lesson in how things were done thousands of years ago.
Yes, perhaps.
Ready, and lean forwards, lean backwards, to the left, to the right, arms up, arms down, to the left.
In the small town of Carrotton in South Australia's Flinders Ranges, an idea no one thought would work is having a big impact on this rural community. A 50-strong male choir made up of local farmers and station owners will sing the national anthem to officially open the town's number one social event, the Carrotton Rodeo, at the end of the month, raising money and awareness of men's mental health issues in the process. Hello, I'm Lauren Waltuta. I've come along to one of their rehearsals to find out how this unlikely band of singers has come together and who's taken on the job of teaching them all how to sing.
I'm Wayne Williams from live at Carrotton, and I'm the president of the Carrotton Rodeo Club. John Parnell mooted the idea. He waited till we're all sitting down, and then he suggested that we have a men's choir of 50, apparently 50 men singing together. It's the required number to give the best tune. And, yeah, we all thought it wasn't too bad of an idea, and it's grown into something fairly big.
So how do you think all the guys are sounding?
They're sounding very... Well, I thought it was very good.
Most of them don't fancy themselves as singers on their own.
When I was at school, I'd be the first one in the choir that would be culled, so I'm not too sure how my voice will be. But look, I'm going to have a go.
But it's that have-a-go attitude that's helped attract about 50 people happy to sing the national anthem at this year's Rodeo event. Larry Williams from Carrotton says he doesn't think the final product is too bad.
Well, I think as a group it sounds pretty good, actually.
You seem surprised.
Actually, yes, it is a bit of a surprise.
So is singing something that you've done before?
No, definitely not. It's the hardest thing I've tried to do too.
The hardest thing? I mean, you're a farmer in pretty tough country.
Yeah, but we don't sing up here. We do a bit of swearing.
Most of the men credit Adelaide-based choir leader Sandy McMenninham with the quality of their performance. Each rehearsal, one of the station owners flies down to Adelaide to pick her up.
I was amazed. There's nobody singing out of tune, unless they're singing so softly that I can't hear them. But they're all singing in tune, which is great, and they just sound so fantastic together. And so initially we were just going to do one verse and that was it. But because the guys sound so great, we've added a bit more to it, and I won't say.
So what kind of things have you been doing with the choir to get them ready?
We do warm-ups and getting their diction right. So we're going, ma, ma, me, mo, moo, and one, one, two, one, one, two, three, two. We didn't do that one today. Some of them never sung before. Some have sung at school, of course, and never sung since then. So it's just amazing.
Well, you talk to all of them and they say, I'm not much of a singer, but how have they sort of responded to maybe doing something a little bit out of their comfort zone?
They've just gone straight into it. But these guys are willing to try all these things and to practice it. They're practicing at home. They're practicing out in the fields. They're practicing wherever they are, in the cars and the planes. And they're getting better and better and better. So who knows where they might be next.
After four, ready? One, two, three, four.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Was Shane Rowe, wife of one of the men, who saw it as an opportunity to raise money and awareness for men's mental health.
To see these guys congregate in the club rooms and not realise what they're doing for their mind and their body, and just socially to get together is a huge thing. And it was actually quite moving, the first rehearsal. It was unreal.
In what sense?
Well, you can imagine if you were in a pub and they would get together and have a sing-along and have a beer, whereas these guys were rocking up at 10:30 and having a tea and a coffee and then actually singing and getting taught properly. It was just amazing.
Were you surprised with how well everybody did get involved?
Yeah, I was. I kept on hounding my husband, Paddy, you know, you're going to go. And he's, yeah, rightio. But all of them were saying it. But I think deep down they were so interested and were really passionate about doing something. And it's actually for themselves as well.
As well, the Beyond Blue part of it. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, that goes back to the first rehearsal, and I sort of had it in the back of my mind when they started it. And to sit there and be a bystander watching all these men come together and know that they've all been through trials and tribulations of their own, to look at it in a therapeutic way and a social and mental way, I couldn't see any more fitter than, like, you know, raising money for Beyond Blue and awareness, because these guys are doing it without them even knowing.
The Carrington Men's Choir in fine voice there at that rehearsal, thanks to Lauren Waldhuter for that report. Still to come on this special summer series of A Country Breakfast, we celebrate the work of volunteers by going weeding in Tasmania. We'll meet the crew responsible for shearing the Wataka mob in South Australia's Gawler Ranges and chat with shearer's cook Elva Barker, who's been happily dishing up her famous Johnny Cakes in sheds across the country. Gold fever also strikes grey nomads travelling through the Pilbara in Western Australia, and bison replace cattle in the camp drafting arena. Apparently, they're great to train with.
All right, let's go. Nice. Mouth on the outside. Top side.
It's really slow. Like, I suppose like going back to preschool, you're just learning step by step slowly. It all comes together at the end of the day, hopefully.
Well done. Good work. Keep going round.
Camp drafting bison, who would have believed it? That story coming up later. But let's continue our travels today, pulling on some heavy-duty gloves and getting in amongst the weeds on Maria Island.
We did a lot this morning. Every year across Australia, tens of thousands of people give up their time to battle weeds and other invasive threats to the environment, like these volunteers with Drive Galore. We're on Maria Island, just off Tasmania's east coast, where volunteers are stopping a serious invasion of a weed called canary broom. I'm Rose Grant, and I've joined the Wildcare Friends of Maria Island Sweeping the Broom Eradication Team. We've almost achieved that goal, but don't be fooled by these cheerful voices. These volunteer weeders go bravely where no one on a wage would go.
I love coming out into the bush. I love the company and I love doing the exercise. To me, it's an escape from the everyday routines at home. It's just a beautiful place to work.
Relatively.
Down the bottom anyway, it was beautiful, thick soil.
Okay. And how many times have I been here? About three, four? Quite a few, yes.
I'm Sally Salier, a Wildcare volunteer.
And what brings you back?
I think because I am a weed tragic, a weedaholic. I guess for years I was a bushwalker and enjoyed the environment greatly. I've got a great deal from it. In my older years, I don't feel like carrying a heavy pack for days on end. I can still be out in nature and I can still be of a great deal of use, helping the environment and getting my exercise and still being in nature.
Qualities of a volunteer, Matthew?
Qualities of a volunteer. Some people you never see again. They come on one working bee and that's the last you ever see of them, because you've got to be prepared to work during the day together as a team. So that sort of cooperation helps to keep you going, because it's quite hard work pulling out broom in the bush. It's not easy work.
So what brings you back?
Brings me back is, I think, meeting some of the regular volunteers. Maybe meeting new volunteers. I feel as though I'm doing something for the environment. Many things you can't do individually, and this is one way of sort of contributing to the environment, I guess, and to the community.
It's right out on the point, at Fisher's Point.
Where are we?
We're looking at the map.
Yes, this is Benaki's Valley on Morar Island. We're working on the largest known site of broom, which is probably the last site we have to do.
But it is interesting, isn't it, just the way it spread?
Oh, it's incredible, and we think it's a very early introduction to the island, planted around Darlington, and then carried perhaps by boots and up the track to Bishop and Clark. And once it gets established, of course, the animals take the seed off the plant, or the flowers, and it goes through their gut and spreads right down into the valley.
So it's delicious to the native animals. What sort of plant is it?
It's Genista monpetulana, one of the broom family. There are quite a lot of broom weeds in Tasmania, but this is the only one we have here, and there have been numerous attempts to try and contain it. But it all started with a ranger in 2007 who decided to get contractors in, and to do that we needed mapping done. So we started mapping the broom, not really knowing where it was. And this was all done by volunteers, basically.
And you're one of the volunteers, Anne Booth. What had you think, yes, we can do this? Because just looking at this map, as you say, it's been everywhere.
Well, it has, but I don't think we ever imagined clearing it. It was always, we'll try and contain it. And that was the main thing. And the initial concern was having it along the track where people saw it and they thought, oh, it looks awful. So that's where we started. People saw it up the valley and they thought, this is not good in a national park. We just kept weeding ourselves in the isolated patches and following up on the contractor's work.
So how many in this volunteering group have you got this week working on this patch?
We've got 11. Yeah, clear a lot of weeds with 11 people.
Well, I'm looking at this map and I can see that it's been 11 times how many working bees over the years?
Our first official working bee on this one, 2005, we've had about 25 working bees. But those early ones, it was just the weekend, arriving Saturday morning, leaving Sunday afternoon. We thought, well, we won't get very far with those hours. So we've made it into 4 days at a time.
And I'm really glad I've come on this trip because there's only one little patch of red. All the primary control is going to be done.
Once we've done that. That's the known weed, yes. That's in Benaki's Valley. And we never thought we could get to it because the vegetation's so rough. But having found this route up the creek and then 80 metres up the slope, it's been quite accessible. Because it's not accessible to contractors, really, and not sprayable because it's such mixed native vegetation.
And, Ruth, when you say the territory's so rough with a smile in your voice, I should ask some of your other volunteers here. Terry, you're a first-timer.
I am, yes.
Yep.
Tell me about the conditions.
Interesting. It's a learning process.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen you down on your hands and knees.
I've found some very interesting bugs and snails. These are the things your feet are banging on and you don't notice because you're so busy looking ahead or looking up in the trees if you're a birdo like Phil and myself are. But getting down there and you're really seeing stuff in detail. And the company means a heck of a lot. It's really good. The conversation doesn't stop while they're working. It's ongoing, echoing through the bush. No, it's been an eye-opener and really enjoyable experience. And I'd just recommend it to anybody, really. Just seeing something a bit different than what you would do on the normal touristy routes.
There's a fair bit in the planning beforehand. Having competent staff, that's the main thing, and we're continually training people and trying to encourage young people all the time. Yeah.
Yes, it's all in the planning and the team you have around you. Hello, I'm Brooke Neindorf in the spectacular Gawler Ranges in South Australia's mid-north. I'm at Wardika Station, about 75 kilometres inland from Port Augusta, where shearing is underway for another year. Wardika runs about 11,000 merino sheep, so it's a logistical challenge to make sure everything runs smoothly in the yards and in the shed. Contract bull classer Tom O'Connell and the shearing team reckon it will take them a couple of weeks to get through this mob. What's a typical day like for you and your team?
Quite long. I'm up here at 7. You know, working in the contract team, it's always, you're always after numbers. And so we, yeah, As long as we keep a harmonious balance in the workplace, everything seems to go smoothly.
Is there a few laughs, especially on a Friday?
Oh, always try and make it fun, yeah. Yeah. If you can't enjoy your work, well, you're in the wrong game, aren't you?
Exactly. What sort of numbers is sheep are you getting through each day?
We're doing about 1,000 a day here for, yeah, the six. We've got a learner on at the moment too, so that's keeping the average down a little bit. But overall, yeah, they're happy with the numbers. I don't want to put too much pressure on the poor owners here, but they've got to get them out as well as get them in, so, yeah.
What do you enjoy about your job?
The travel and the people, mainly. Yeah, you meet some fantastic people, dedicated, yeah, and get to see a lot of the country. You know, there's plenty of opportunities for having young guys here shearing, as you'll know. You know, they've shorn in the UK, Europe, New Zealand, obviously, and, the opportunities for young people now are much greater than what they were when I first started.
I went and had a look at the shearers' quarters before. I imagine on a Friday afternoon, be a few good tales told.
A few good tales. It's nice to sit around and have a drink after work and we'll have a bit of a laugh. Yeah.
Especially with a view like this.
Excellent. Yeah, we do a lot of work up in the Flinders too, and you get some, yeah, places, you know, people go and pay to stay at. We get to stay there for free.
Alice Ingram. I'm a rouseabout and I'm from Victoria, Dimboola.
How long have you been working in shearing sheds for?
Almost 2 years now, and yeah, I really, really enjoy it. Always like the agricultural side of life, and one of my best mates back home was a rouseabout, and she kind of got me into it.
So where's it taken you? What sort of travel do you get to do?
All through Victoria, and currently all up through South Australia, and I've done a bit of work over in New South Wales as well, and I have friends who are currently over at Western Australia.
And where do you want to take this? Are you keen to keep staying here, or are you interested in heading overseas? Where can you see yourself going?
I'm happy here currently, but maybe in the next couple of years head overseas or something. I'm not too sure yet.
There's a team of six contract shearers working this shed. Their boss is Peter Smith from Port Augusta.
Yeah, excellent blokes. They all work well together and get along well, so it's great. One from Ireland, Northern Ireland, Mark Little.
Do you get a lot of guys from overseas?
I do, because we do advertise worldwide. This year we've had some from Chile, our cook's Filipino, from Ireland, Wales, Scotland.
Why do you advertise overseas? Is it just to broaden what you bring in, or is there enough shearers here in Australia? Why go over there?
There's still a shortage of shearers in Australian shearers, and there's a lot of overseas that come here to have a look around and work.
What's a typical week like for a shearing team? What sort of organising goes into it?
We've got, naturally the sheep, enough sheep to last the week, and supplies, because in some stations we might be 50 or 100 kilometres from town, so you can't duck into town to grab a loaf of bread, so you've got to have everything on hand.
And you said you bring a cook with you as well?
Yeah, a supplier, cook, a complete team of staff.
And do they have a preference of what they like to have for tea?
No, they're pretty cruisy, and the cook is excellent. She puts on a wide variety.
Now, what's this that you've got in your hand here? I've been hearing this a bit. How does it work?
That's a sheep rattle, and what that does is just helps them into the pen a little bit easier. They don't like the rattle.
As Peter said, one of his international shearers this year is Mark Little from Northern Ireland. He's only been in Australia since September and is finding quite a few differences to shearing back home.
Probably money's quite good, sheep's different and stuff, so there. Probably the heat and stuff too, different climate, that'll be sheep main thing, so it is.
How do you go in the heat? Over here it got quite hot here the other week.
Yeah, you sort of body adjust and climatise, so you do, so first day or two the heat sort of knocks you about, but after that you get on pretty well, just cruise along.
What's the shearing industry like in Ireland? Is there a lot more young people coming into it?
It's pretty shearing industry back home. It's a lot of young folk, but it's shearing season back home, and it lasts about 2.5-3 months, so it's not really a full-time job for anyone. It's more young people in college and stuff. It's more their kind of thing to do. If you want to shear full time, you have to travel, so you do, that kind of way.
And are you going to travel for a little while now?
We've been travelling 2-3 years now, so I've just travel, take one year at a time and see what happens.
I come from a
family of 12, 10 brothers. Nine of those are shearers, one's a rousey, and also my baby sister, she's a rousey. My dad's a presser. My mum was a shearer's cook. I learnt my cooking from my mum.
To say that shearing is in Elva Barker's blood is an understatement. She and her family are a shearing team, all rolled into one. Hello, I'm Cherie McDonald on a property in Wycliffs in the far west of New South Wales, where Elva's been feeding hungry shearers. Now, she's been doing this for the past 8 years, working with teams across the country. And when she's not out bush cooking, she's working in cafes, restaurants, even the local hospitals, dishing up some family favourites.
Most of the shearers told me that they love my puff pasty pies, and they also like Johnny cakes. I cook Johnny cakes and dampers.
So what's a Johnny cake?
It's just a bread. It's a flat bread. It looks like Lebanese, only for it rises. I think that the Aboriginal people invented that bread. I've seen my grandmother cook it, my mum, and that's where I learned to cook Johnny cakes from, off my mum, and they're the only guys that I've known that cook the bread.
So how do you cook Johnny cakes?
It's just flour and water, and it's cooked on a gridiron on the open fire. It's looks like Lebanese bread, but it rises. You can split it in the middle and fill it with any fillings suits your fancy.
You said that the shearers tell you that they like the food that you cook, but how easy is it to cook for shearers who have all different kinds of tastes?
Oh, yeah. It is sometimes when you're first starting off, like the first day or two, you sort of work the shearers out what they like and what they don't like. You don't come across very many vegetarian shearers. Most shearers that I've cooked for, they love their meat, they love their veggies, but every gang out of them, probably two or three of the shearers would have sweets. Yeah, the ones that don't like sweets, they'd rather have a beer than have a sweet, so that's fine by me.
So how many people would you generally cook for in a shearing team?
The most I've cooked for in the shearing team was 15, and probably the smallest probably about 8.
Those guys do some pretty hard work, bent over for hours on end shearing. Are they pretty hungry? Are they as hungry as hard as they work?
Oh, I think some of them are. Some of the guys, they have big appetites. Some of them come back for seconds, and others you'll see they're plates piled up like a mountain, and I don't know how they fit it all in, and then go back to work.
So what do you like? Wow. So what do you like about cooking for shearers?
It's more easy in the sheds than it is in a cafe or in the hospitals. And I love the bush. I love spending time out in the shearing sheds because I come from a small community and it's out in the bush, and I really love the bush life.
So do you ever sit down and talk to your mum about some of the foods that you cook now and some of the foods that she used to cook when she was a shearer's cook?
Yeah, we used to sit down probably every second day and talk about meals, what other different meals we can prepare together, and some of the old recipes she have given to me and that I've kept that I will not trade for anything.
So do you cook kangaroo much?
Yes, I do. Here's the tail, it's kangaroo tail. I'll boil those down and fix it up like a P&M soup.
How do you find the shearers take to that kind of food? Because not all of the shearers would have eaten kangaroo before.
No, you get a lot that haven't eaten kangaroos, or eaten a Johnny cake, or some other dishes that I do that they've never ever tasted before in their life.
And so when they taste it, what's their reactions usually?
Oh my God, that's nice.
So can you see yourself continuing cooking for the shearers for a while to come?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yep. As long as there's a gang out there that's looking for a cook, well, I'm here. All right,
let's go. Nice. Mouth on the outside. Top side. Out you go. Out wide. That's it. You'll catch him. Just keep going.
A horse and a rider well chasing done. A beast around a stockyard. Nothing unusual about that, is there? Well, what if I told you the beast in question was, in fact, a bison? Yes, you heard correctly, the Native American bison. Well, that makes things a little bit different, doesn't it? Hello, I'm Kim Honan at a camp draft training clinic at Willow Warren on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, where they're using these bison, not cattle,
to train up would-be camp drafters.
Stay behind him on the inside. Now come up on the inside a little bit. Keep coming up the inside a little bit.
Apparently bison are well suited to the job. They're slower than cattle and don't tire as easily in the yard, making it easier for riders to learn the correct cutting techniques.
Right, now around the outside.
The dozen animals being used here belong to Kendall Nielsen.
To the bucket.
They don't go sour like cattle. We can keep using them. I'm pretty fortunate with the ones I've got trained that I can slow them down and speed them up. For doesn't matter who we're doing it with. If we've got a beginner to an advanced, or same with our horses. If our horses are green to advanced horses.
Good, stay there. Keep going behind his tail now. Chase his tail.
Well, talk me through the procedure when you actually got the bison here in the camp and you're directing and trying to train the rider.
When we start in the camp, we only put one in at a time. So what we're trying to do is get the horse and the jockey into position. The beauty with the bison, if I've asked them to come up and they're in the wrong position, we can stop, tell them where they are, and the bison will stand there and wait in the position till we get them, tell them, explain what's gone wrong. And then we'll get them to work backwards and forwards across the camp and get in control on the horse. If the horse isn't keeping in control, we can just stop and the bison will stop and wait. We get it all happening again, and we'll cut out in the camp, that's in the yard. And then once we get them cut out in the camp, we go out the gate into the big arena. We've got a course set up, same as what we are drafting, and we can slow the bison down or speed it up to with whatever we're going to do. And we're trying to get the jockey to manoeuvre the cow around the course and get in the right position, get your horse controlled, get right shape, and the biggest thing is we're looking for our safety, so they're learning to where the safe place to be. That's the beauty of the bison. They slow down, run nice, neat round circles in the right position, and so they can learn where the right spot is and the wrong spot is and be really safe. That's our biggest thing for our drafting, to be safe.
Gavin Saul is a relative newcomer to the sport of camp drafting, with only 12 months under his belt. He believes training with bison is ideal for both him and his horse.
It's interesting because you can just go nice and steady and, like you said, position your horse. You can stop your horse, get him under control and go again. The bison's still there waiting for you. You know, you're not chasing them all out of the paddock.
And so you're learning a lot more than what you would be with cattle?
Yeah, cattle is really quick, so you've got to think quick too. Where here, you can take your time and think of what you're doing and actually getting in the right positions, and the instructors are telling you to get in that position and you've got time to do it. It's really slow. Like, I suppose like going back to preschool, you're just learning step by step slowly. It all comes together at the end of the day, hopefully.
Right down there. There you go. Go, 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 go,
the 20 riders taking part in this weekend clinic can thank Sharon McKeever for the event. She's the secretary of the local camp draft committee and keen to improve training, not just for novice riders, but also more experienced camp drafters like herself.
Everyone that came has improved or bettered in some way over the weekend. It's beneficial to everyone. If you get to a point to say that you can't learn from someone, it's a pretty sad state of affairs. You can train all day, every day, but you can't see what you're doing wrong. And it's just so good to have someone like these guys turn around and say to you, try this or try that. And yeah, you just see an automatic response. Your horse, oh, that worked.
When you hear that sweet little sound, you think, this has got to be a nugget. And every day you wake up, even if you haven't found anything the day before, you go out with full optimism that you're definitely going to find something today.
To say that Greg Piedermonte and his wife Lynn have got gold fever is something of an understatement. This grey nomad couple from Port Lincoln in South Australia are not only prospecting for their own nuggets, they're turning other people's finds into pieces of fine jewellery as well.
We'd actually become very hooked on it all.
Yeah.
We're obsessed with it.
G'day, I'm Lucy Bell in the gold prospecting hotspot of Marble Bar in Western Australia's remote Pilbara region. Greg's a goldsmith by trade, and he's turned his caravan into a mobile jewellery workshop.
Well, we've really got a travelling goldsmith shop. We've got rolling mills, we've got soldering jets, we've got drills for dremeling, all of the tools that are required to hand make jewellery. Out here, we've got the nicest piece I've made this trip so far is the dragonfly. It's all 18 karat gold outline, and then we've used small nuggets, I've actually found those nuggets, to put into the wings, and then I've done the body in 18 karat white gold, diamond set right through. I did do a map of Australia this morning, same design, and that has got marble bar nuggets in.
And what there a glisten in that sunshine as well.
I've even got Tassie on the bottom there, which is always forgotten. And what we would do with this, if, say, for instance, you were born in Perth, we'd set a little diamond where Perth is. Started doing jewellery when I was 12 years old. I'm now 66. My uncle was a goldsmith, my brother's a goldsmith, and my son is a goldsmith.
So tell me, what's brought you on the road then?
Well, I retired 10 years ago, and my son took over the business in Port Lincoln. When I retired, I started building houses, a bit similar to jewellery, only a little bit bigger. But I really got sick of that and missed the artistic side. So we decided, after a trip through the goldfields, when they found out that I was a goldsmith, they said, why don't you set up and come up and convert nuggets into jewellery? So I thought, gee, what a good idea. So we're doing it and we're loving it. There's a nugget where I've set the Southern Cross in diamonds in it, just a flat nugget. And I've set the shape of the Southern Cross in it. Sold them. Here's a nugget Lynn's got that we're tumbling for someone. Have a look at that. 62 grams. It's still got the quartz in it. We're putting that in the tumbler just to brighten up the gold so that it shines up.
It fits very snugly in the palm of my hand. Yeah. Yes.
And is that how gold would normally look when people find it in the bush, surrounded by quartz?
No.
Not always. Iron stone often. Sometimes they get a slug that's just quite clean with nothing in it. This one obviously has come off a quartz reef. And the lady was lucky enough to fall over it.
It really has that incredible glint and glow to it. It gets the heart pumping a little bit, doesn't it?
If we found something like that, we would do backflips. It took me a long time to find my first nugget. Unlike Lynn, she picked up a 10.2 grammar as her first nugget, and that was at Mosquito Creek.
Wow.
That was my first piece.
You must have been absolutely
stoked. Jump, dance. Kissed, hugged, cried.
Had a bottle of red that night.
No,
or
but
two.
We actually had been searching for 6 weeks and hadn't found a thing.
I did find a little patch in sandstone where we picked up 48 nuggets in 4 days for a whole weight of about 11 grams. They were like fly specks, we call them. It's a silent machine. Normally you would put the gold in here and you just wind the handle like so, and that extrudes the gold out a little bit thinner. And if you want plate, you run it through the plate section there. And once you've got it down small enough, we've got what we call draw plates. And that's over here. We just poke the wire into these small draw plate holes, grab a pair of pliers, and extrude it through till we get it down to the size we want.
Because gold's quite malleable, isn't it?
Yeah, very soft. You can pull 1 ounce of fine gold down to about 1.6 kilometres long if you've got the right equipment.
And what are some of the sort of most common requests that you get from people? What do people like to have their find turned into?
Oh, look, we're all grey nomads on the road and we've all got grandchildren, especially granddaughters. You know, stud earrings, maybe a pendant, and sometimes we do the odd ring.
What do you like about the trade?
I think it's the artistic part of it. Meeting the people, being able to look at a nugget or a stone of any sort, really, and working out a design after you talk to the person. Find out what sort of style of jewellery they like, then you sit down and you design something specifically for them.
Greg and Linny Piedamonte creating fine jewellery from the gold which grey nomads are finding in Western Australia's Pilbara. Thanks to Lucy Bell for that story. And that's all we have time for on the first in this special summer series of A Country Breakfast. I'm Edwina Farley. Stay listening to RN Summer. A Current Affairs special documentary is coming up right after the news.